The foods we eat, if not sterilized to death, contain billions and trillions and maybe even zillions of foreign microorganisms. That we routinely consume the genes of all those foreign organisms leads some to ask, why fear the foreign genes of genetically modified foods?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 763rd edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Rockhampton who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Nikki?
Good morning.
You're taking off on a sabbatical. We want to thank you so much for all the wonderful editions of the Food Chain Radio that you piloted through outer space. Really appreciate it and look forward to your return.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure. It's been a blast.
All right. Well, folks, a difference of opinion exists as to whether foods that have been re-engineered to contain foreign genes should be labeled as such. Had a few shows on this along the way. Those who do not, for one reason or another, trust in the efficacy of foods that have been re-engineered with foreign genes by commercial interests to perform in unnatural ways are asking that the foods thus re-engineered be labeled as such, and as they must be in 50 nations around the world. Others see the vibrant populations of microorganisms that populate all living things and ask, what's the fuss? There can be, after all, 100 million microbial cells on every square centimeter of a living plant's surface. You know, when we routinely eat billions of foreign bugs with every meal of living food, what's wrong with taking the genes of a few of those bugs and using them to re-engineer how a plant goes about living its life? And thus we come to the question of the day. Why fear genetically modified foods? Here to help us consider some answers, we have Stephen Savage, who is a plant pathologist, an independent plant pathologist, I understand. Welcome, Steve, to the Food Chain.
Thank you.
Steve was kind enough to graciously send a dissenting opinion with respect to the question we had before, which was, should we label genetically modified foods as such? And Steve made the comment, well, why bother? We routinely eat all of these foreign genes, so we should really look at what a foreign gene is and talk about it, and perhaps not be so anxious to freak out over the issue of genetically modified foods. And is that about hit the nail on the head for you, Steve, right there?
I think, yes. It comes down to the issue of sort of emotive language.
Right.
There's ways to communicate things that either do or don't, you know, simply communicate what's true, but they can also intentionally or not sort of stir an emotional response that's not really appropriate.
That's a great point. Now, as a scientist, are you forbidden the use of emotive language?
Actually, editors for scientific journals would not go for that, no.
Good. Wonderful.
You need to state things accurately, but that also does make scientific writing rather dry.
Good enough. So you're an independent. You've been working in biotech for many, many years, 30 years.
I've been working in agriculture for 30 years. Sometimes I've never actually worked in biotech in the sense of, you know, I've not genetically engineered crops, but I've actually known the people and I've had colleagues that have done that since the late 1970s.
Well, good. Well, thank you for standing up for them, and we really appreciate your coming to the table with this interesting notion about all of the foreign things that we do eat, and that's what we want to talk about today. Well, we always ask our guests who paves the way, and as an independent, who do you who commissions your services?
Well, in terms of the consulting that I do, it's all sorts of different entities, small companies, large companies, grower groups, food companies, yeah. It, over the years, dozens and dozens. In terms of what I do, in terms of writing and blogging about agricultural issues, I do that on my own time.
Okay, good.
Probably not clever enough to figure out how to get paid to do that.
Okay. Well, and I read a great blog post that you were kind enough to send me, and so we'll bring that up as well. What was the address of that blog post?
Biofortified.
Biofortified.com, and you can read Steve's. So this whole question's a preview question on another show we had, an edition of The Food Chain. We talked about whether we should or should not label genetically modified foods.
Right.
And you said, well, wait a minute, what's all the fuss here? So I'd like to start off this conversation, Steve, by asking you, who is against labeling genetically modified foods and why?
Well, actually, the most important somebody who's against it is the FDA. Mm-hmm. Because, if you look at it, the FDA tries to really stick to science in terms of what they require for official labeling. And so their objection to doing the labeling is we sort of reserve that for something where we really need to communicate something important, something that's a real risk, something like that. And we don't sort of respond to the politics of the day, we go by the science. And so they have not been willing to do it. I mean, if anything that, you know, some of the things that people claim about biotech were true at all, it would have been banned long ago. But, you know, 16 years into it, turns out none of that is true.
Okay, so the principal roadblock or the principal organization standing up against the labeling of genetically modified foods, which, as I understand, is required in 50 other nations, is the FDA.
Right, but operatively in the other 50 nations, it's kind of a non-issue because if you think about it, most genetically engineered crops are things that are fed to animals, mm-hmm. like cotton or something
right.
like that. And so even though, for instance, Europe imports huge quantities of U.S. crops that are biotech crops, they're just for animal feed. So it's the whole idea of it being a consumer labeling issue is a non-issue.
Okay.
They don't label the animals that are fed that.
Hmm? And that's not true here?
That's true here. The only thing that would be different is also there are food ingredients that come, you know, from cornstarch or high fructose corn syrup or soybean oil or something like that, and that certainly goes into human foods here.
Mm-hmm.
But on the whole, those are rather purified things. They don't, you know. It's almost a non-issue in terms of what might be contained in that.
Well, if it's a non-issue in Europe, then why are we so adamantly opposed to it here?
Well, I don't think we are. There are people who are. The FDA, in other words, they just say, look, all the evidence, and there's tons of evidence. That Biofortified site is mm-hmm. run by graduate students, and they sort of track the studies that have, you know, looked into the safety, and
right.
they're up to 350 studies that have demonstrated the safety of biotech foods.
Mm-hmm. Good, and we'll get to those down the line. But first, I wanted to talk about our intrinsic fear of bugs. And
yeah.
you kindly pointed out that it's kind of ridiculous to be intrinsically fearful of bugs because bugs are everywhere. And being a Montana boy who was raised on a farm, where there were a lot of bugs, I guess I never developed that fear like some city people do when, you know, there are no bugs. But
yeah.
let's talk a little bit about, when the couple minutes we have here before the break, about all the bugs that we do eat. And there are a lot of them, are there not? Oh, I mean, we're talking about foreign bugs on the living foods that we eat.
Well, again, the term foreign is kind of an artifice, but yes, there are things that live everywhere.
Let's define that term then before we head off into the sunset here. When we say foreign terms, what I guess I mean, not to be emotive, is that bugs that are not essential to the foods that I'm aiming to eat. If I'm going to go eat
yeah.
lettuce, I expect to eat lettuce and not other things. And the other things that I would be eating along that happen to be abiding on the lettuce would be the foreign things.
Yeah, but the thing is, you know the old saying that nature abhors a vacuum. And if you've got a leaf surface, which is got a nice little humid, you know, few micron boundary layer, and it's got some nutrients that leach through the surface of the plant. That's going to be filled with microbes. That's just the way the world is.
Okay, and, you've got to hold that before we go to the break, because this is a wonderful point, and I think it's really important for all people to realize just how vibrant the things that we eat really are with life, most of which are foreign genes. And so when we talk about foreign genes, we really need to consider about all of the genes that we do eat, and that's exactly what we're talking about with Steve Savage. We're talking about why we're fearful of genetically modified foods and taking genes from one species and splicing them to the genes of another species to create a third species. Why are we so afraid of that? You're invited to participate. Why are you afraid of GMOs? 831-479-1080. Right back with Steve Savage on The Food Chain.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, welcome back out there. Yeah, I have a question for you. Why are you afraid of GMOs? I know you are. I know you're lurking out there in the bushes, and I know you're afraid of them. And I know you probably even signed a petition to label them here in California. And I, full disclosure, I signed that petition as well. And then Steve Savage sent me an email and said, "Why are you so afraid of bugs? You eat them all the time by the billions and zillions and trillions. You eat them so often that they're always there. And so why are we so afraid of these bugs?" And that's the question of the day. Why are we afraid of genetically modified foods? Steve, we're talking a little bit about this wonderful little microclimate that exists on the surface of a leaf. Can't really see that microclimate, but if we imagine it, we'll imagine it to be this little micro-paradise where all kinds of things live, right?
Right. Right. Not just bacteria, but yeasts, various other fungi, probably a fair number of mites, all sorts of things.
All sorts of things. And, of course, we eat them.
Yes. And in fact, unless you've just cooked the food, you're eating them alive. Now, that's
right.
Sound creepy, but that's the truth.
So when we go out and buy some fresh lettuce and fresh vegetables and make a fresh salad and rinse it off in cold water, we don't really get rid of them all, do we?
No. You might. Microbiologists talk about this in terms of logs. So, if there were 100 million on the leaf, that's 10 to the 8th bacteria. And maybe by washing it, you'd drop that to 10 to the 7th. And as microbiologists say, what's a log between friends?
Uh-huh. So we, instead of eating zillions, we only eat trillions, right?
Right.
Okay, so, and these bugs are everywhere. They're on the surface of plants, or on the roots of plants, inside of plants. They're here, they're there, they're everywhere.
Yeah, they are. It's actually, I don't think most people know it, but the human body is made up of about 1 trillion cells. But you, walking around, are 10 trillion cells, and the other 9 trillion are things that live on and in you that are microbes.
And thus, they're everywhere. Now, you talk a little bit about how these bugs infest, of course, all living food, and the food that has been cooked is, of course, they're cooked bugs, but they're there nonetheless. What is the difference then between what we're talking about, the all of the foreign bugs and their foreign genes that we eat routinely, and genetically modified bugs?
Well, I think the main difference is that the gene for a genetically modified plant is actually inserted into the chromosome of the plant, whereas the same gene, which it would very likely be on some of your food, a BT gene, for instance, would be inside of a bacterium, which actually makes it less likely that you will almost instantly destroy that gene in your digestive system. It might make it through.
Let's pick up the Bacillus thuringiensis and use it as a way to carry our conversation along a little bit here. Bacillus thuringiensis is what?
It's an interesting thing. It's a fairly common bacteria that lives in soil, and there's lots and lots of different strains of it. And what's interesting is that each strain makes a protein which is toxic to a different insect, and they're extremely specific. And that's what's always been really attractive about them. That's why we've been using them for 60 years as something to spray on plants to kill insects, because it's, you know, not disruptive like a broad-spectrum insecticide. The ones that will kill caterpillars won't kill beneficial insects or beetles or anything else, and vice versa for the ones that kill beetles.
So essentially we can raise Bacillus thuringiensis for specific bugs and then put it in a package and sell it to each other, and we can go out and manage those bugs.
Yeah, and it's been a mainstay of home gardening and organic and conventional agriculture for 60 years. I mean, you might be familiar with a product called Dipel. I think one of the ones that's been broadly sold. But yeah, we've been spraying those. In fact, I went on California EPA has a website where you can find out exactly what has been sprayed on anything in the state, the only state that requires that, and looked it up. And in terms of things like that, BTs and other biocontrol agents that we spray on plants, we are using something like 807,000 pounds of that per year in California.
So it's pretty popular stuff. I'm going to pick up a caller here, Rory, who knows a lot about everything. Oops, I just lost my caller, my guest.
You pick That's okay, him. Michael.
you're now my guest.
The whole time.
Somehow I forgot to lock my other guest in. So, Rory, go ahead. You're this guest right now.
Quickly, the thing is, I've looked at this from both angles, both in ag and then watching some of the research that's come out where they're finding some of the BT toxin compounds in placental tissue, umbilical cords, and these are proteins that if they are on the outside of a plant being used for insect control, usually the stomach acids are going to digest it and get rid of it. So it's not an issue. But we've never had it where the BT toxin is now in every cell in that plant tissue that we're trying to digest. So somehow it is getting through our digestion system. We really don't know what that means. Is it good? Is it bad? Well, no, they said it wasn't supposed to happen. So I would point to that, and not only that other, the glyphosate or Roundup herbicide and its metabolites are also being found in cord blood cells and in placental tissue. So, yeah, it's very, very micro amounts, but it is getting through. And I would also ask Steve, you know, what does he think about this discussion that Dr. Don Huber's brought up about this new pathogen, a seemingly new pathogen, they're calling it a microfungi, just seems to be in soils associated with constant use of Roundup.
Well, geez, Rory, you're stealing all my questions today. A good job of doing it, though.
Well, I got to be somewhere at 9:30, so I'll have to listen to the rebroadcast on the web. But I just, you know, I've looked at it both sides, Michael. Spraying a BT compound on a crop, which is, you can do that on organic because it's an organic compound, is much different than inserting that BT toxin in every cell of that plant tissue. Plus, the other thing is, worm populations of different types of insect genera or species have actually become resistant to BT toxins because they're constantly being exposed to it as they eat through these BT modified plants.
Well, okay,
so we're getting resistance anyway.
Before you run off, and we have Steve back on, but now, do you want to have genetically modified foods labeled as such?
Absolutely. I the buyer beware, caveat emptor. I want to know everything about my food supply as possible, and I'm fully aware of the number of microorganisms that are out there naturally. But, Steve, what do you think about this latest research that has shown some of the BT toxins in placental tissue?
Steve?
So it's going through the digestive systems of humans, and it's not getting digested as we were all told it would be.
All right, Steve. Thank you very much, Rory. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you. It's interesting. I actually read that paper that people have cited, and I expect strongly that most of the people who have written about that have actually not ever read the paper. That's pretty standard for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really look into their methodology, there's some questions. I've written the authors and asked them, and I haven't gotten any response yet. The one thing is, they don't actually have any way to know that the BT that they detect with an antibody is from a GMO crop. In fact, if you really think about it, that's kind of one of the least likely explanations.
Okay, hold that. We're going to have to take a quick break.
We're
going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll pick up this whole notion of why we fear GMOs. And I have a list, and Rory helped kick that notion off. And do you have a list? Are you afraid of GMOs? Why? Give us a ring. We're at 831-479-1080. Because we have Steve here, and maybe he can help us to be less emotive about our considerations of GMOs. Right back on the Food Chain, Michael Olson here. Well, folks, the foods we eat, if not sterilized to death, contain billions and trillions and maybe even zillions of foreign microorganisms. That we routinely consume the genes of all those foreign organisms leads some to ask, why fear the foreign genes of genetically modified foods? Hey, here's a question somebody just sent in. He says, what's the difference between Brussels sprouts and boogers? Well, kids won't eat Brussels sprouts. I guess that's the way most of us are when it comes to genetically modified foods. But why? Why are we afraid of genetically modified foods? Steve Savage, you write about how we totally inundated with foreign microorganisms and their foreign genes. Why do you think we're afraid of the foreign genes of genetically modified foods?
I think we don't actually do a very good job of educating people about what genes are, even in the first place, and the idea that a foreign gene sounds very exotic, but you know, if you look at it, genes are made of five things. There's the ribose backbone, and there are four different bases. That's all there is in the genes of anything. And so it's not like, you know, there's some radically different thing. It's just the spelling that they're in. They're in things called codons, sets of three base pairs, and those translate into what proteins will go on to it. And that's basically sort of the universal code of life, and that's why it is easy to take a gene from one organism and put it in another, and it's quite at home there. It's not like it's something very different than any other DNA in that host cell.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I signed the petition to request that foods just so genetically modified would be labeled as such.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it simply because I just want to know. Now, I don't know whether genetically modified foods are harmful or not. I have no idea. But there are some things that cause me concern, and I'd like to lay those on the table today, and hopefully you, Steve Savage, can help allay my fears. And so let's fire away with the first thing here. And that is, it seems to me, you mentioned a code of nature. Right? It seems to me like taking the genes from one species and inserting it into the genes of another species to create a third species breaks that code of nature. Am I wrong?
Actually, you don't create a new species. Species would, to change species, you would be changing thousands of genes. So, no, you're not creating a new species. You're just expressing a different gene in a different place. That's not a new species.
Well,
in fact, it's you know, I mean, it's one of thousands and thousands of thousands of genes.
Okay.
Species.
But here let's take up the BT situation. We can take the a gene from the Bacillus thuringiensis bacteria,
right,
and insert it into the genes of a corn plant, and create a plant that kills bugs.
Right, kills a very select group of bugs, but yes, it does. And that's been really a great benefit. For instance, there are 7 million small-scale farmers in India.
Oh, no question, it's a benefit to farmers. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, I sort of reject the idea that something that's good for farmers is not therefore also good for other people.
Okay.
Because without farmers, you don't live.
Well, that would just be one of my concerns, you know, that we can create, we take the genes from one thing and insert it into another and make it to do something that it was not by any way, you know, designed to do by nature itself, and
well,
thus the corn that can kill bugs.
Nature would never have come up with corn. If you look back historically, what the origin of corn
mm-hmm.
was with a desert plant in Mexico called Teosinte.
Mm-hmm.
And if I showed you a picture of Teosinte, you would never.
It would look a lot different.
A million years, but mm-hmm. that would become what we call corn today.
Yeah, on my wall, I have a selection of corn from the Urubamba River Valley of Peru. And there must be 30 different corn there. And they all look like something other than the corn I know. But.
Right.
In any case, we take those wild plants and we breed them together, and we, you know, down through the millenniums, and we end up with sweet corn. But we have never before, to my way of knowledge, taken the genes from one species and inserted them into another species.
Well, actually, we did on a rather large scale 10,000 years ago. By accident, not that mm-hmm. people knew what they were doing, but the crop that we call wheat today,
right.
You can read this in Jared Diamond's book, Guns, Germs, and Steel.
Right.
He describes it very nicely. What we call wheat is actually a hybrid of three species. I know it's mm-hmm. spelt and Iger and something else. And accidentally, by agriculture and by the selection pressure that primitive farmers were putting on things, actually kind of created this new hybrid that had never existed before and yet has been one of the main supports of the advance of Western culture over 10,000 years.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely right. Let's move on with it. Bacillus thuringiensis. Whereas organic farmers sprayed about the plant once in a while, genetically engineering allows us to put this plant pathogen or this bug pathogen into the plant into every cell of the plant. Am I not correct? Is that true?
It depends on the promoter that's used, but yes, mm-hmm. commonly that would be the case.
So if a bug were to, you know, fly along and take a chunk out of a leaf or an ear of corn or a root or pow, it's gone.
No, it's not actually. What it does is it binds very specifically within the gut and the insect stops eating and
okay.
dies eventually.
Okay, pow, it starves to death.
Yeah.
Okay, good. This gets to me to my next fear, which is if we eat something in which every cell is infused with Bacillus thuringiensis, that just seems like a lot of BT to be eating.
Okay, but think about this. A bacterium is maybe 1/1,000th the size of a plant cell. And within the plant cell, you know, you have the one gene there. Or, you know, whatever, the bacteria that could be on the surface of your arugula, for instance, your organic
mm-hmm.
arugula, could easily have far more BT toxin on it than a corn plant, you know, a bite of a similar size of a corn plant that was genetically engineered. It, you know, we're not talking small numbers when we talk about things to do with bacteria. And BT, it's a remarkable thing, actually, within a bacteria. It makes what's called a crystal protein. So it's not just a little bit of protein. It's a big old chunk. If you take an electron micrograph of that BT cell, there's a big old hunk of BT protein in there. It's not in small quantities. I'd say it's, you know, there's mm-hmm. nothing that says that the fact it's in every cell of the plant means we're talking about more.
Okay, fair enough. That's your answer. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're going to the phones when we get back. 831-479-1080. The question of the day is, do you fear genetically modified foods? If so, why? We're curious. I have a couple of concerns I'm putting on the table, and I'm lobbing them to Steve across the net, and he's whacking them right back at me with answers. And we're curious to hear what you have to say as well. We're at 831-479-1080. When we come back, I'd like to talk about the research of others. Talk about the research into genetically modified foods, and Steve says there are like 300 research studies, that, and there are many more that's saying the opposite side too, so we'll talk about that. Do stay tuned. Well, why do you fear genetically modified organisms? We have a few reasons, and we're throwing them on the table today, and before we go to the phones, I'd like to throw another one on the table for Steve and see how he answers it. You mentioned at the top of the program that the organization that does not want us to label genetically modified foods is the Food and Drug Administration. Correct, Steve?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay, good. Well, the FDA troubles me simply because one of the leaders of the FDA is a gentleman named Michael Taylor, who is one of the hired guns for the Monsanto Corporation. Now, for decades, the Monsanto Corporation, today it labels itself as a life sciences company because it manages and holds the patents on biologically engineered organisms, of which BT corn and whatnot are part of. And yet for many years, it was a death sciences company because what it did is it manufactured things, chemicals and whatnot, to kill things. And I'm talking about PCBs and DDT and dioxins and glyphosate. So here's a company that made a big switch from being a death sciences company to being a life sciences company, and then inserted and developed patents on all of these things, and then inserted one of its hired guns in to be the food safety czar for the United States of America. And now the Food and Drug Administration is saying that we shouldn't be allowed to label our genetically modified foods. Now, so it seems like there's a conflict of interest there that troubles me.
Well, I think you may have set a new record for the amount of emotive language within a paragraph.
I'm trying.
Okay, let me...
Well, hey, maybe you could do it in non-emotive language for us so that...
Yeah, look, the other day I was cleaning out a file cabinet and I came across a program that is titled Risk Assessment in Agricultural Biotechnology, okay? Mm-hmm. Proceedings of an International Conference. And this was a big conference involving hundreds of scientists and really, really looking carefully into this whole idea. This was 1988, and that was certainly not the first time. It's not as if this is some new thing or, you know, the attitude about this changed because of one appointment in one government agency. This is something that the scientific community has been looking at very carefully for a long time. Mm-hmm. That 1988 conference was 8 years before there was even one GMO commercial crop planted.
Sure.
So it's not, you know, it's not like this was done casually. Mm-hmm. This was done very carefully with a huge body of scientific information.
And lots of support, too. And that's one of the things that, again, that troubles me is that who's supporting the studies? Who's paying for studies?
There's a recent publication. I blogged about it not too long ago. There was a review by European independent scientists who looked through the literature to find long-term animal studies with mm-hmm. genetically engineered crops. And they found 24 of them, and basically, you know, all kinds of different species involved, all kinds of different conditions, and basically no issues, no problems.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like this hasn't been looked at by independent sources. So people frequently say that, but that's actually just not true at all.
Well, one of the independent studies that I considered is one by Dr. Don Huber, who is a plant pathologist, a professor emeritus from Purdue University, who did find an entirely new virus or bacteria or something.
Okay, there's a big problem there.
Uh-huh.
And honestly, as another plant pathologist, and I've spoken to many of his colleagues, I'm afraid Dr. Huber is a huge embarrassment.
Oh, now is that emotive language?
Yes, I suppose
so. Okay, fair enough.
The reason that he is that he's out there making very, very public claims about things, but he hasn't published any of this. And mm-hmm. it's kind of the rules in science that you
peer-reviewed
back up
studies.
What you say with data and you make it something that's repeatable by another scientist. And he doesn't come close on any of those things. And I think the fact that people are just willing to believe whatever he says without data speaks more to the credulity of the audience than anything else.
Fair enough. Let's go to the phones, folks. The phone numbers today, 831-479-1080. Are you afraid of genetically modified foods? And if so, I'd like to know why. Let's talk with Margaret.
Yet another epic food chain broadcast, Michael Olson. Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, I think that the public no longer trusts our government, our scientists, or the FDA.
Why?
We're all enmeshed in the Monsanto money machine. And to accept to label GMO is merely to accept informed consent.
Mm.
You know, yeah. I mean, we have informed consent to what we eat, and I would like to know if this guy Steve Savage would like to be a human test. A test guinea pig for this GMO. Eat GMO for 3 years, and let's see how your health is.
Well, Steve?
Yeah, you're doing.
Well, I'd be happy to do that. Actually, the one case where I'd like to be able to do that, and it's likely that I won't be able to because of people being scared about it, is to do with GMO sweet corn. Okay? Now, the only reason there is going to be GMO, or there has been actually since the late 1990s, GMO sweet corn, is because it's so closely related to field corn that mm-hmm. you can breed between the two and move the genes over, and you don't have to go through $100 million process.
If they have GMO sweet corn, what will we Montana boys do for the bugs in our ears of corn? Folks, this is a food chain. Right back with Steve Savage. Are you afraid of GMOs? And if so, why? I'd like to know. Steve can answer it right back. Well, folks, do you fear genetically modified foods? I don't know if I do. I just don't know. And since I don't know, I'd like to have the option to know if the organisms are in my food or not. Steve Savage, I have to ask you, do you think that You should know what's in your food with respect to genetically modified foods? Do you think the food should be labeled?
You know, actually, back in the day, in the mid-90s when this was being discussed, I was one of the people who said, you know, why don't you just label anything that, you know, might have those kind of ingredients? Because we're mostly talking about things that are ingredients in processed
food. Yeah, right.
Other than sweet corn, there's almost nothing other than that and papayas that will ever be mm-hmm. genetically engineered in terms of fruits and vegetables and things like that. It's just for economic reasons alone, you would just never do it. So I just thought, you know, just put may contain. Because if you actually were to do it in a rigorous way where you would know, you would add a great deal of cost to things. Remember, mm-hmm. we're talking about crops that move around in 110-car train.
Sure, right.
This is the
bent corn. By a train load of bent corn that gets turned into high fructose corn syrup that gets put in soda pop, and away we go. Something changed your mind. Did you get bit by a bug?
No, it's just, once you're into something 16 years, it's kind of silly to do that. Also because, think about it, American consumers are conditioned to marketing of non-existence. So we buy things for what's not in it. which is kind of fundamentally absurd. But it's like we go from boogeyman to boogeyman. Oh, it's saturated fat. No, it's cholesterol. No, it's high fructose.
Sure.
No, it's gluten. You know, and it's like we're just because that's all unofficial. That's not U.S. you know FDA labeling. We're just manipulated by all that information and just kind of go from the one thing to be scared of to the next. And I don't really see that as a positive thing.
Okay, fair enough. That's the answer. Teresa, what about you? Do you think we should label genetically modified foods?
Hello, Michael. And I feel that Steve is intentionally obfuscating this this argument. And I'll give three examples. He's talking about it being emotional.
Emotive.
Emotive. And that's an argument that's been used to silence women for generations because women tend to care about things like the health of their children. And
what's never worked for me.
Rather than the bottom line or profits and rational things like that. And so I think that the emotional argument is the human argument for life. He's talking about that the FDA shouldn't respond to political pressure. Political comes from polis, which is the city, which is the people. Why shouldn't the FDA be responding to what the people want? And then he talks about Europe and how in Europe it doesn't matter whether they're labeling it because there's not food in, it's not food for people. But which came first? Is the fact that if they did have to label it, people wouldn't buy it to eat it themselves. Is that why there isn't a market there for food that is FDA? So the question that I'd like to ask Steve is whether 50% or more of his funding comes from agribusiness or government.
Steve, thank you.
By funding, do you mean what I do to make a living?
Yep, that's it.
Or what I do to be involved in the public conversation?
We're out of time.
Yeah.
So give her a quick yes or no.
It would come from things that you might call agribusiness, all sorts of different things, including companies.
Steve, we're out of time, but I just want to thank you for joining us today, Steve. I really appreciate your calling my attention to the subject. And thank you all out there for tuning in The Food Chain. Next week, more What's Eating What Radio.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.